All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast. This is that podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. And we did an Oscar-winning foreign film just a few weeks ago before making a pit stop over in Chinatown for the Chinese New Year and Valentine's Day. And we're back in Oscar-winning foreign film territory. Tonight we're going to be doing Life is Beautiful. This is episode 221 of the show. And you can find them show notes at the old actualanarchy.com/221. And before we get into this episode with our guest, who's a returning guest, we'll introduce him in just a moment. Let's say hello to Robert, who is still on the road to recovery from his various ailments. Looked like you were rebounding a bit and getting better, but now seems that there's been a resurgence. How are you feeling with your, in the pre-show, you were telling me about this special brew that you've made to perhaps aid and comfort you. What are you calling this brew, and how do people make it?
Daniel, this is ambrosia. This is the nectar of the gods. This was handed down to mankind from, it's either Bacchus or Dionysus. I believe it was Bacchus. And what you do is you take some wine made out of your favorite fruit. This particular beverage right now in my hand is made from watermelon wine. I don't necessarily recommend watermelon wine. I recommend raspberry or blackberry, raspberry being the preferred method. But you do about 1/3 raspberry wine to 2/3 of your favorite fruit tea, depending on your level of infirmity. So if you're very ill, you're probably going to want to go half and half. But you probably don't want to go more than half and half. I mean, you do what you want, but I like it like this. This is about 1/3 to 2/3 with wine to water ratio. And it is fantastico. It is a quite refreshing, quite soothing of the neck area, the bronchial areas, all the important parts that you want to soothe when you are a mucus factory that has gone bananas, like I have been the past few weeks.
All right. Well, very good. Sounds a little fruity to me, but I'm glad that it's making you feel better. And hopefully you are on the road to recovery and all of that. Other than that, how are things going with the business? I know that you've had snowpocalypse recently from the polar vortex. I think that's what it was called. It gave us a little snow down here. I mentioned that to people last week. My kids went sledding all week at a nearby park. We were talking about that in the pre-show bonus content available for Patreon supporters at actualanarchy.com/Patreon. Do you still have snow on the ground over there? And how's that impacting business and traffic and all of that?
Well, first of all, you owe $1. You got to put that in the pun jar because that was pretty bad. But yeah, the snow around here is really nasty. It doesn't like to thaw or really melt for a long time. It was in town at our Friday location. It was melting somewhat, but it was basically kind of dumping off the roof, and it was collecting right at the base of the steps. And some people came along and cordoned off the steps without alerting anybody inside that they were doing so. And then they put traffic cones in front, basically like warning people, hey, watch out for this snowfall, which, you know, apparently can get you rather well sued if our friend Patrick McFarlane is at the wheel of that lawsuit. But it made all my customers think that we were closed. So we might have lost a little bit of business. I'm not sure. But for the first 2 hours of our opening on Friday, it was people were coming in going, are you guys open? What's going on? Until I realized what had happened, I went out there and cleared the steps and opened it up, but it would have been nice for whoever had done that to actually have alerted me, because they did do it at some point when we were just inside after we had finished setting up. But anyway, it's a long, boring story. And long story short, snow sucks, and let it all melt.
All right. Well said. And quite appropriate that we have a guest who doesn't have snow and will not probably ever have snow again if he continues to live where he's living. It's the Anarcho Viking, who lives now in the Florida, the free state of Florida, one of the freest states in the nation. I think recently in the, was it the Heritage Foundation ratings or something like that, but also with the Governor DeSantis, who is actually pushing back against the COVID hysteria and making Florida a desirable place for people to be. So you're very lucky to be there. And we will introduce you right after these messages. Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood and Robert Paul Johnson. We are the Last Nighters. You can find us on the Liberty Movement's YouTube channel and also at lastnighters.com. This is going to be episode, 164 of this here show. So you can find the show notes more at lastnighters.com/164. We're going to be doing the Italian foreign language Oscar-winning film from 2007, Life is Beautiful. And if that sounds familiar, it's because just a few weeks ago, we did another Oscar-winning film, foreign film, when we did The Lives of Others. We made a pit stop in Chinatown for Big Trouble in Little China with our buddy Snobby Bobby of the Not For Everyone podcast. But now we're back at Oscar-winning foreign film flicks that happen to be based in fascist regimes. So, you know, that put that in your trivia and win a few pennies. So anyway, our guest is Olaf the Anarcho Viking. He's been on many times in the past. His first episode was The Outlaw King a couple of years ago. He also did Snowpiercer and Spirited Away, and most recently was on for The Purge, which we did right around election time. Olaf, welcome back to the show. We always have a good time with you, and welcome back.
Yeah, it's great to be back again. And yes, there's no snow here. The other day I took my daughter to swim lesson and in the pool, which is outside in about 80 degrees weather. So it's nice. And I'm sitting here in my screen porch and enjoying the, you know, cooling down weather during the evening. It's pretty nice actually. So yeah, everything you said is pretty spot on. It's probably the best state in the, you know, kind of semi free quasi-fascistic in some places country that we live in now, but it's okay here in Florida. So if anybody wants to come down here, I'll highly recommend moving as soon as possible.
Right. Yeah. And that's something we've been looking at, moving to a freer location. And Florida, even though it's like the furthest one away, it does look to be the most desirable at this stage of the game. And now you, of course, have lived in other states in the union, and two of them are the least free, as far as I'm aware. So there must be quite a contrast for you.
Big leap. Yeah. And before that, I grew up in Sweden, which is, you know, I mean, you can argue it's somewhat more free in some areas and less free in others. But overall, I think it's probably on net a little bit less free. So it's not, you know, Florida is by far the best place when it comes to having choices. I mean, it could improve. We could be better on, I think we're kind of mediocre at guns and stuff like that. You know, so there are definitely areas where, and the weed, people want the weed, right? I don't really care about the weed, but that's probably if you want to do drugs and stuff like that, it might not be the best thing.
Right. But in other respects, it's more free. Though, if I recall, there was a governor election a couple of years ago that was pretty close.
And oh, very close. Yeah, no, we had a terrible. I mean, it was had the other guy won. I mean, you can look him up yourself. Gillum, who was the mayor of Tallahassee, I think, the most criminal city in Florida, who ran against DeSantis, and he was in the lead and almost won. And I think DeSantis won by less than a percent. Like it was like 0.5% or something.
Wow.
Wow. It was pretty close. And that guy, like a year ago or something, I can't remember how long he was found in a Miami Beach hotel room with, you know, overdosed on methamphetamine with a homosexual prostitute right there also. So, yeah, that's the kind of person who almost governed us.
Yeah. So, I mean, that goes back to my whole, one of my arguments against elections is, well, if you're going to invest that much power, look at how close you got to getting someone like that who, you know, who knows what policies they would have enacted. But
we would definitely have lockdowns right now. I mean, yeah. I have no doubt whatsoever. It would have been a terrible situation here. See what difference that can make.
Yeah. So anyway, we should probably get this episode started here. And how we do that is with the old Google description. So I'm going to share my screen. Let me see if I can get this to work properly. I'm a little bit aged these days and things flummox me, but I think it's showing up for everyone now. So Life is Beautiful came out in 1997. I think I said 2007 earlier in the show. I was way off by a decade. This came out 1997, like I just said, PG-13. It's a war/romance film, 2 hours and 2 minutes, and it's almost two films in one. At least that's how it kind of plays as you watch it. You got 8.6 out of 10 on IMDb, 80% Rotten Tomatoes, 59% Metacritic, but 94% of Google users liked it, and so did the Oscar committee. The description reads, a gentle Jewish Italian waiter, Guido Orefice, played by Roberto Benigni. Am I saying that right, Olaf? I know he's one of your favorites. Roberto Benigni?
Benigni.
Roberto Benigni. Yes, that's Roberto Benigni.
Benigni. Yeah.
Benigni.
Meets Dora, a pretty school teacher, and wins her over with his charm and humor. Eventually, they marry and have a son, Glossu. Their happiness is abruptly halted, however, when Guido and Gusu are separated from Dora and taken to a concentration camp, determined to shelter his son from the horrors of the surroundings. Guido convinces Gusu that their time in the camp is merely a game. The release date in the U.S. was October 23rd, 1998. Director and star is Roberto Benigni. It won an Academy Award for Best Actor, and I think he also won Best Foreign Film, something like that. So he did fairly well with this one. And Robert, I will go to you for your opening, as I'm sure there are a couple of interesting things that you would like to talk about on this one.
Well, I think my criticism of this movie is going to mostly focus around, I don't even know. I guess I'll just get into it. So, Bella Vita, Life is Beautiful. I've never seen it. Oh, very nice. That's good looking. I've never seen it before. Although I remember when it came out, or when it like hit the Oscars, and it was a big story that Roberto Benigni, you know, gave this big passionate speech or something, like where he was like super stoked to be there and just soaking in all the adoration and that kind of thing. And I guess that kind of colored my perception of what to expect with this. Like, I expected something kind of groundbreaking for the time. I didn't expect what it is, which is a real throwback film. It is definitely something that almost copy-pastas some kind of comedy from the 20s or the 30s and brings it into kind of the modern era a little bit, but with the direction style of very flat, unmoving cameras, it feels like a TV show. So it really, to me, it felt like this could have been made 50 or 60 or 70 years ago and then colorized. And it's a fun little story in that the main character has a lot of charm. And he's kind of almost a caricature of a human being, where he's just eternally positive and happy and clever in a kind of a simpleton way. You know, he's not like super smart, but he kind of makes things work in his own little special way. So he does have a certain amount of charm to the audience. Like, I did like him. And I did like the way he solved problems, although they kind of fell in his lap a bit. Like the way they told the story. So they set things up for the hat bit and then the riddle bit. And then they had payoffs later on where
it set up, they just kind of like all day long.
Yeah, they were setting it up and they're paying it off, and they paid off in a kind of clever way, but not in a way in which the main character kind of orchestrated. More of like, oh, here's an opportunity, perfect timing, perfect happenstance, and then oh, okay, it's going to work out, and then oh, there's an idea, and I solve it. And for the audience, or at least for me, it was kind of fun, but it didn't really lend me to a very protagonist, like a protagonist, like someone that really drives the story through their choices and that kind of thing. It was more like this is falling into his lap due to a result of his likable character. So he's kind of doing it, but he's not doing it through his choices. He's doing it just more of who he is as a person. So it was okay. I mean, I liked it, but the story seemed kind of like it was just falling all over the place in that sense. Like it wasn't really directed, if that makes sense. But, you know, it's something like this I had never seen before. I have to say, though, that if this movie had intended me to laugh, that was not succeeded in any way. There were seemed to be some kind of slapsticky moments in the beginning of the movie. And then here and there where he falls down a little bit and there's some pratfalls and there's one scene where he's like holding up a dog. They were kind of cute, but they seemed really like quaint, you know, like something that would have really enamored an audience from 80 years ago. So maybe other people felt differently, which is great. If you were charmed by that, fantastic. If you really laughed, wonderful. But for me, it seemed like those kind of things fell flat and I was left more with a fun, kind of charming little movie that ultimately left me feeling a little bit hollow. Like there wasn't the big heart that I was hoping for. But those are my opening thoughts. And feel free to dissect or destroy.
All right. Well, Olaf, I know a lot of those are fighting words because you were telling me before the show and when we first started talking about doing this movie that this is one of your favorite movies. It's a beautiful film. And Roberto Benigni is one of your favorite actors. So, you know, make your case. Maybe Robert would be able to watch this again with fresh eyes after hearing your arguments. I will comment a little bit that, Robert, I think that old style, I viewed that as it feels like a foreign film. Like it just has that feel of like it's not a U.S. film. And it also felt like it's two films kind of smashed together. Like you had that first one that's like setting up him as a person and his kind of affability and likability and his wit and charm and finding those situations that pay off for him. And then they contrast that with the second half of the film where he's now utilizing those skills that have been presented and the relationships forged in the first half as his kind of motivation for the second half and dealing with the horrors of it. So that's kind of like how I was sort of viewing this one. Well, I have some notes, but I'll go to you, Olaf, because I already asked you a question, then I sidetracked you a little bit.
Yeah. So, no. Okay. So, first of all, I mean, yes, it's maybe my absolute favorite film. And Roberto Benigni might be my favorite actor ever. I mean, he's also a stand-up comedian. It's not just that it's an Italian movie. It goes deeper than that. This is like a proud Tuscan movie. This is like a Tuscan movie. It's, you know, this is Florence. This is where he comes from. This is and it really comes out in the movie. But I understand what Robert is saying, and it gets to me now when I hear him say this and the critique, because you cannot translate all of this that he's saying. Okay, it's impossible to make this appear in the same way if you just read the subtitle. Like I don't watch this movie with subtitles. I watch it in Italian because it is so good. When there are these characteristics in like the where it comes out, like the Tuscan dialects and the ways of saying things and the ways of like putting out words and behaving that makes the movie so brilliant. But it doesn't come off that way. You can't translate everything and it's not going to be as funny. So I get that aspect. It's hard to properly take it in and enjoy it unless you fully understand like where he's coming from and you know the way they speak certain dialects and stuff like that, the way they use words and the way they behave, it's hard to get that that doesn't translate very well, and it's not as funny unless you speak and understand the language. But
right. And you spent time in Italy and speak Italian, so
yeah,
this,
yeah,
you're able to receive this differently.
Yeah, very much. And I lived in Florence, and I can just imagine what this was like. But the genius of the film itself, in which it has been criticized for, is that it takes this really, really tragic event and it turns it into something funny. Like this, Roberto Benigni is a brilliant stand-up comedian in Italy. And they make it so into a case where you can laugh at these things. And it's cathartic in a way. And I think that's why people love this movie so much. Because it has turned this really horrible thing in human history and made it into something that is, in many instances, is really funny. And like he makes people laugh. He makes people laugh in this tragic situation that we revisit, and makes he makes comedy out of it. It's just it's hilarious. There's so many instances in that movie where this comes off and where you just have to. Smile at least, or laugh out loud when he's like, "Oh, this is how he's doing this," you know. that's why what's so great about it. You know, there are these regional specific like characteristics that you can spot and you recognize, and they're funny. How language is applied and behavior and all of that, but it's also how they have made the movie. I think it's absolutely genius how they're taking the idea of the Holocaust and like just turning it into a funny film like that. It is.
Yeah. I was reading that there was a little bit of controversy about that because some people equated him making light of it or making comedy related to it as almost a denial, you know, like that's like the gut reaction to things. It's almost like calling somebody racist, like, oh, you're just a denier or whatever.
Right.
But I think that he spends that first half of the film sort of building up the character and filling in the comedy that will then pay off later. Like this movie is all about setups and payoffs. And I know that Robert and I have talked about movies in the past where there's like all setup, no payoff. And that's like so excruciating because you're waiting for this thing to happen and then nothing ever happens. But this movie is like bang, 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 like all the way through. But I think it has to have that established first half so that then it makes sense in the second half that he is this way.
Yeah. Yeah. And he sacrificed himself for his kid, you know, at the end of the day too. He makes everything for his kid. You know, it doesn't matter how much he suffers and what he's going through. He always makes the child feel, you know, okay, comfortable and not wanting to leave the camp. You know, it's unbelievable. Yeah. And, yeah, exactly. And it received some criticism. But like, look, comedy is subjective. Why wouldn't you be able to laugh at something like this? You know, laughter can make people get over things like this also.
I mean,
obviously, it's widely appreciated, even in the Jewish community. So I'm not sure what all the, hectoring is about.
Yeah, and what's interesting is a lot of that backlash is from like when this was made in 1997 or whatever. I can only imagine if they try to make a movie like this now. Like context certainly matters, but in today's outrage climate, context doesn't seem to matter anymore. So like the scene where he's pretending to be the school inspector and he's supposed to give this presentation on like race or something and superiority, and he gets up there and he's like, "Look at this belly," you know. I mean, it's hilarious, but I can imagine that would not be doable today. But anyway, Robert, I'm going to get you in on this. You were about to say.
I was just going to chime in and say that I did watch the film in the dubbed version, so I could see what Olaf was talking about with the nuance of translation and, you know, that him speaking in certain dialects would be lost with an English, you know, dub. So that I could see, I'm sure... It still seems like a bit of a throwback, though, because it felt very much, I don't know if you're familiar with the TV show Olaf, but there's a TV show back in the 70s, I think, maybe the 60s, called Hogan's Heroes. And it was all about a group of POW survivor, you know, camp inmates. And it really took the piss out of German guards, making them look really stupid. And I felt that this movie kind of did the same thing. It really kind of, the Germans weren't so much scary as they were kind of oafish and stupid. And then even when he was like going to get caught, I didn't feel like a real sense of danger. Like, he was clever when he, you know, the little boy said, thank you. And then the guy ran away to get like the bigger German guy. And then he was teaching everybody, thank you. Like, he's clever, but I never felt that sense of like danger. So I could see why people would, you know, feel like this movie was somewhat offensive in the sense that you're kind of making light of a very dark situation. And I can understand, you know, anything's fair game in comedy. I don't care, but it did like there wasn't this sense of danger. I'll just put it that way. Even though he was doing all these things to protect his child, because certain death was imminent for both him and his kid, and there was massive risk at all times. I don't think the movie really conveyed that sense of foreboding. Maybe because the tone was just so light. Do you have any sense of what I'm talking about here?
I'll chime in just real quick and then I'll go to Olaf. I wonder if that was maybe intentional, because then it makes him getting gunned down in that alley like really stand out, you know?
But does it though? Because that happened off screen. Like, I wasn't even sure he was really dead.
Well, it happens off screen, and at least I felt when it happened, like that's what won at the Oscar. That's the thing that was like, all right, we've taken this film that we've built up this whole way, and then we go into the second act and now we're in the camps, and now it just got real right at the end there. You know, that's the thing that kind of kicked it over. And
did that really hit you in the feels? Because to me, it felt like some kind of surreal, like I wasn't even sure. Like, I didn't know who was going to come out. Was it going to be the soldier with the gun, or was it going to be him with just like running away, scampering away, doing some kind of like Jim Carrey impression? I wasn't sure.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's, you're almost hopeful that he's the one that comes out of that alley, but then he doesn't, you know?
Yeah. But I don't know. I got issues with that. I wanted to ask you if he's like father of the year candidate, or if he should have fought that guard, and he should have, you know, worked on those escape attempts and done some other things. I don't know. I think probably he was father of the year because he isn't a fighter. Obviously he's this lanky little weird comedian guy, but I don't know. When I get put into those kind of situations, I have a very much fuck you mentality. I have a very much like, you have no right to do this. I'm going to fight you with every breath I have. Now, he was doing what he thought he had to help his child survive. I can understand that. So I'm not a father. Let me pose the question to you two fathers. What do you think? Do you think he's father of the year here, or were there some room for mistakes there?
All right, Olaf.
Yeah, I mean, it's sure. He could have maybe give it a little bit of a fight, but I think he knew that his time was up. He knew that he was going to die. He knew that when they were going away with those trucks, that they were just taking them away and killing them, right? That's what he said, you know, jump off those truck. And his wife, I think, must have done that because she survived, right? And you see her at the end of the movie. But yeah, they're not, you know, really getting into details of people getting murdered here, because it's also a movie that should, you know, I think it was intended for a larger audience. Maybe, you know, for smaller, you know, children too. And, because, you know, you can see once they get into those camps and the wife, Dora, and she looks over and she says, but where are they taking the isn't it good that the old and the children don't go to work? And they said, well, and then the other woman says, well, they go to the gas chamber and they kill them. Yeah. Right. So, and then she looks out the window, but you don't see anything about the gas chamber. Right. So you don't see these horrible elements. And I think that's part of the idea, because it's not supposed to highlight that, but it's supposed to take something that everybody already knows was a horrible, tragic event in human history, and making it lighthearted and something that people can also laugh at. I think it's intentional, but I don't know. I feel, yes, I think you're right that maybe he could have put up, you know, nothing to lose anymore. He knew that he knew that those were the last steps that he were taking. He knew that he was going to get killed. And yet he is, you know, showing his kid, you know, pretending that he has no fear, basically walking away. It's like, yeah, we're winning 60 points and we have the 1,000 points and you get your carro armato, you know, the tank. So yeah, but both father of the year, but also, you know, maybe I would have acted a little bit different, tried to be a little more desperate perhaps, but
yeah. I got to agree for the most part, though. I did take some issue with just the nature of his fancifulness lended himself to a lot of misrepresentation of truth and sort of like embellishment, just even in the first half of the film. And I think for me, I would have been a little bit more upfront with the kid, even though he was 4 years old. My kids are 5 and 7. And I mean, they understand a lot of stuff more than most adults do in some respects. So I would have had a hard time like lying to them like that, though. I do get the intention there is to, you know, make the situation not like freak out the kid and help him get through it with like a, you know, keep a positive outlook and whatever, so that the kid doesn't just freak out and get in total despair. And I think that there was also a lot of, yeah, they're not going to show you all of the horrors directly, though there were moments like when he's going through the courtyard in the fog and then he sees just the pile of bodies. I think that's where, you know, you're like reaching that danger point. Cause that's like foretelling him, you know, that the end for him is very near. So I don't know. Did that stack of bodies, it looked like, you know, a backdrop, so it didn't look real, but I think that was maybe just like part of the style and sort of intended to be that way. It's supposed to be like in a theater production where you're like representing something that's just massive. And, but they didn't want to like make it seem like CGI, a big stack of bodies, that kind of a thing. I don't know. Not sure what I'm trying to say here, but I feel like that was the, where they were kind of building up that danger element that wasn't there before or as much before.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know. I'm glad this movie exists. It's an interesting departure because this came out, 5 years after Schindler's List? Very different in tone, but basically covering similar territory. I mean, not totally different movies, but set in the same place, essentially. I don't know. There's something inside me, and this has always bothered me about history and human nature in general, is it we're far too trusting of a people, of a species, where you've got these people that are just being led to their deaths, just accepting what these captors are telling them, just being led by the nose to wherever, to the slaughter. And people never, this is true in history, they just go. They just went along. Because why? Maybe because they feared a worse fate, or they were promised something. But why would you ever accept the promises of these horrific thug master people? I don't know. It's something that's always bothered me. You see it in this movie where he just like meekly goes with the guard to his death, meekly goes and gets gunned down as if he's like, well, I've done all I can for my boy. It's time for me to die. Doesn't it bother you guys? This aspect of humanity.
The character though that did, you know, the kind of act contrary to the general theme which you're bringing up is the uncle. The uncle saw this way before. You know, he saw this years before when his house got vandalized and you know, at the pre-wedding party there, when he carries her away at the horse, when they paint his horse, and Achtung, cavallo ebreo, you know, Jewish horse. And Roberto Benigni is like, come on, that's, you know, that's nothing. How can they know? They're just a bunch of jokers. They can't know, like, you know, the horse was Jewish and yada, yada, yada. So he is constantly downplaying this as it's going on, you know. But the uncle knew. The uncle saw what's going on. He knew it all the time. He was just too old and weak to actually fight back for anything. I mean, he knew that he was stepping on the train, that he was going to not last. He saw this. But Roberto Benigni, I think, would be more kind of like the blue-pilled person, right? Kind of the joker. No, this is nothing. That, you know, it's just a bunch of jokers trying to, you know, play tough. And, you know, don't worry about them. This is not going to happen to me. But he says it, you know, you better get used to this. They're going to come for you too. The uncle tells him this, and he's trying to downplay it and joke it away. Yeah, but that's, so the uncle kind of sees it. He's more, you know, he sees through this completely. He's the red-pilled character in the movie, and he's the one that dies as soon as he gets to the camp, it seems like. So Roberto Benigni is completely in denial to what's happening. Even at the point he's trying to explain away to his kid, when there's this other store that they want to go into, it's like vietato l'ingresso agli ebrei, ai cani, like Jewish people and dogs can't enter the store. And he's asking, why can't the Jewish people and dogs enter the store? And it's like, well, I mean, shit, they don't want everybody there. Maybe they just don't like Jewish. I mean, the other day I saw, you know, a store where camels and Spanish people weren't allowed. And what should we ban from our store? He's just like spiders and you know, some other kind of
kangaroos. And
and it's just like, so yeah, he's completely clueless and in denial of what's actually happening. And he's constantly downplaying it until it's too late. And you can see it is happening right now. Oh, what are you talking about? You're a conspiracy theorist. Just wear the mask, you know, or just social distance. Just do what they tell you. Yeah, and you're going to say that too when you're in the boxcar. Well, just do as they tell you.
Yeah, I was watching this movie, taking notes for like how to handle the being in the camps.
Yeah. So you see how this can be applied. That mentality that he has, kind of this joker who doesn't take it seriously that they're actually after you and trying to, you know, eventually murder you. And he's just not taking it seriously. And he seems to think that everybody who thinks that way, like his uncle, for example, is just a little bit crazy and you shouldn't really take him seriously. You know,
he had hatched a bit of a plan, or at least a hopeful happenstance, when the doctor who was a guest at the hotel, when he was serving him and doing these little brain teaser kind of riddles. Mm-hmm. And he had thought that friendship forged years before, and him being asked to serve in their, in the camp, like commissary area or whatever, like where the Germans were.
Yeah.
Was sort of like an inside invitation to help with his escape or save him and his son. But that guy, no, he didn't view him as a friend. He just viewed him as like this plaything, like this, he's interesting and we exchange riddles and he doesn't think beyond that.
Right.
So it's almost this NPC style, like relationship, very shallow.
Yeah.
And doesn't seem to connect that, no, this guy's about to die.
Yeah.
Almost his hand, you know, like he's like a doctor, I guess, running experiments or, you know, doing whatever, kind of like running these camps. And he just, I don't know. It seemed like Roberto Benigni was really counting on that relationship to save him. And then when he realized, he's just oblivious. We're on our own, you know, we're in trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he was completely uninterested in helping him. You know, he was like angry that he couldn't solve the riddle. That's what he was angry about. They wanted to talk to him about, oh, now you can go back to your bunk bed in your barrack, or what do you call it? The kind of like the trailer boxes put up for them to live in, right?
Yeah.
I mean, unbelievable. I mean, it's just so incredibly evil. But that relationship was also hilarious. When you think about it, like he didn't care at all about Guido, you know. It was just, it's kind of like former server friend. It's just totally grotesque, and that's what makes it so funny.
Yeah, and that guy was like full on autistic. He didn't have any sense of the weight of the situation. He was just interested in his own little world, which
no empathy, outside perception, really. Robert, you'd asked about like father of the year scenario. What about the mother? Because she wasn't going to go, she wasn't being rounded up, but she insisted on not letting them go without her, even though she was separated from them and only saw them for a moment. And Guido was doing all of these like grand gestures with things that he was able to, almost things that fell into place for him, like being able to play the record that was the opera that she was familiar with. And he played it out to the courtyard, and he also got on the loudspeaker and said a few things to her. So like, I guess I'm asking about the wife. Like, she didn't have to go, but she basically insisted on going. Was that a noble act? And do you think that it probably wasn't like the wisest thing for self-preservation?
Probably not, but I cheered it on. I was like, hell yeah, that's exactly what you're doing. That would have been me. That would have been, maybe unless I had some other idea of in getting their escape, or something like that. But, if I love with my whole heart and I have these two people that are my world, then yeah, I'm living and dying with them, and we're going to do the best we can. And I'm getting on that train too. Unless I could do something better. But so I was a big fan of that move. And it worked out in the end for her, although she didn't do much. And that was my big problem with her in this movie, was that, I think you can enjoy the film and it doesn't without really believing in the romance. But this movie spends a whole lot of time on the romance. It spends at least about the first half of the film selling you on this romance. And for me, I think that Benigni did a dozen things to enamor himself to the female, but I didn't think that she did anything to enamor herself to him other than being attractive, being nice, and being open to his advances. I didn't see her do a whole lot that made me think, oh man, yeah, he should totally get with this chick. Like, I hate going back to the classic, like, love stories of old, but they almost always, there are always scenes where you understand why both of these people feel the way they do about each other. Now, in this film, I get why he feels or she feels the way about him, but I don't really understand why he feels that way about her. Because for me, she's just kind of a prop in this film. She's just more of an object for his advances and his romantic, his brilliant little romantic moves. Like, he is a guy who is basically throwing himself at her, who is organizing and orchestrating all these little scenarios where she's just like, oh my God, this is amazing. And then she's like praying to the gods, and then the key falls down, and then she prays to the gods again or something like that. And then he gets a dry hat, and, it feels like very magical for her. But for him, I'm just like, she could have been anything. She could have been a cardboard cutout. I didn't really get a whole lot out of her other than her choice to go with them on the train. That I felt was a strong choice. I could feel why he loved her at that moment. But I wish the movie had given me more before that to really sell me on the romance. I don't know how you guys feel, but that's how I feel about that. Daniel?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Like, she didn't have to do much. But I also think that often is the case that a girl doesn't have to do much for guys to be interested.
Whoa.
And we're telling the story of Guido here, I think, mostly. He's the main character, he's the star and director, and he's got all the choice material here. And I think that having her be kind of almost a foil to that, not so bad, not so bad.
I don't think she's terrible. I think you need to sell the romance and have both characters see something in each other to really stoke that flame. And for me, it didn't happen until, you know, the train scene. And then, yeah, anyway, before that would have been nice. Anyway.
Yeah, she has, you know, the female just aura, kind of like attractiveness, beauty that he's obviously obsessed with, right? I mean, this is why he's courting her so badly, you know, all the time, persistently. And that's what we're focusing on, the courting, the natural courting relationship between the man who is has to prove himself to get the woman that he wants, which is like a beautiful woman. And I don't know, it's perhaps, you know, the time that they live, there are just certain expectations to have on women that perhaps, you know, that they're you know, expected to have certain characteristics and skills and whatever that makes them what they are. And but they're really the man that is supposed to do all the work in, you know, this courting relationship that exists. So
right.
But no, I mean, I see what you're saying, though. Like, she doesn't show anything except responding to his tricks, kind of like with the awe, like, well, how did you do that? That's crazy. And how did you just get that dry hat when I, you know, prayed to the Virgin or something like that, which to me is kind of absurd. I mean, why would you pray to the Virgin? She's not Jesus, you know. So
yeah, it's definitely seems more akin to an old fashioned male doing all the effort and courting the woman, and we're just kind of left to assume that this woman is very desirable. I mean, clearly she's beautiful and this and that, but yeah, I don't know. I think more modern takes on romances I've enjoyed where the woman's also doing saying clever things or being very cute and adorable and that kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Looking for the Meg Ryan style.
Yes, I was grown. I was born on Meg Ryan and I will die on Meg Ryan. I'm sorry. I'm not sorry. This is, I want my female love interests to be interesting or funny or charming. You know what I mean? I mean, she has a certain amount of charm, but it's really Benigni is the star of this show. I mean, I think we would all agree that, right? I mean, he's in almost every scene and he is the focus point of every scene.
Well, she doesn't rebuff him, and she is a little bit flirty with him. Like, she's not like turning away his advances. She is being a little bit playful with him, and she's in a relationship.
This is also true. Indeed. With the local bureaucrat guy that.
Yeah. I knew that guy would get your goat, Robert. When, Guido goes there to try to open up a bookstore, and the secretary is like, oh, yeah, it'll take like 2 years. And you need to get approval from this guy. And, you know, you'll get that in a few months. And he's like, well, he's right there. Why can't I just get it right now? And so then he goes and tells to ask him. He says, can you just do this now? Can you sign this now? And he says, oh, well, I leave at 2 o'clock. And he's like, it's 1:50. So it's that bureaucratic nightmare, you know. And I when I was watching that, I was like, okay, it's funny how modern day progressives will say that we just need more regulation to tamp down business and whatever. Well, that's what was happening in this. That's more regulation. That's preventing somebody from doing something that would provide value to others without the blessings of the state. And that's, you know, this is fascistic Mussolini Italy, right? So all those people who are championing more regulation are essentially asking for more fascism. And I thought that was kind of ridiculous and funny.
Yeah, and yet they call him to be the anti-fascist. It's really funny. Yeah,
you can see this still. You know, there is this residual bureaucratic inertia that exists. I mean, it's incredible. Like, this is that's how it works. You know, it's like this is real. You know, they say, oh, I leave at 1, I leave at 2. You know, because then you go home for like 2 or 3 hours or something like that, and then they come back maybe for an hour or two to sleep off the drunkenness during lunch. And yeah, I mean, this is incredible. This is why you have like major part of the Mediterranean economy is like black markets, because you have to work around. You have to work around the government. The government's not giving anything to you unless you pay them a lot of stuff. And so what you do instead is you kind of you bribe some bureaucrat and say, hey, you take this and we have a deal here. You're not going to come and inspect my stuff, my business. And we'll give you a little bit something on the side. And that's how it works. That's how it works.
And, And this is famously led to the rise of the mafia, right?
Yeah.
Where people go to the local Don who can actually get something done, right? Who has the politicians in his back pocket to actually allow the guy to open the business. So you seek favors from the local Don to actually get anything done, because otherwise you're stuck in a bureaucratic morass for who knows how long. So
they when the government failed to take away the trash from the streets in Naples, the mafia stepped in and cleaned up the streets, you know. So this absolutely, this is how
I love it, man. Competing governments, that's great.
Yeah.
All right, well, we are actually running up against time here, so does anyone have any final notes or points they want to bring up before we get into the final summary and review portion of the show? I know that, Robert, you're big on setups and payoffs, and this was in abundance. And I knew that bureaucratic busybody would get your goat a little bit. So if you want to tee off and rant on him a little bit harder, I'd be fine with that.
Well, you loved this is basically the romantic competitor who's not a competitor. So this guy reminds me of the same guy in the same character, essentially, in Three Idiots, where he's just this kind of popular, superficial guy that I guess I'll marry this girl because we grew up together. I mean, we've been around all each other all the time. So she's kind of my girlfriend, I guess. I don't know. We just decided to get married, I guess, it's the kind of thing. And she's looking for more passion, more real romance, you know, someone who really cares about her and really sees in her what she believes about herself. The guy was a total tool. He was fairly superficial, easy to hate, you know, the classic romantic foil villain. And then he was also a lazy bureaucrat too on top of it. So what's not to hate about the guy? There's also the scene where it really illustrates like the banality of evil, where they're doing that calculation issue problem around the dinner table, and where they're discussing about how much it costs the state to feed cripples and how much better it would be if we just killed them all. I mean, just get rid of them. Why are we waiting? It's like a weight around our necks. Let's just murder these people. I mean, come on, they're undesirables. And it was all about the efficiency and the mathematics of it, and not about the humanity and the morality of it.
It was even more than that. They were questioning whether it was an appropriate level of problem for like seventh graders, for kids in school. And not that it was about the subject matter, about killing people, just that it was too big of numbers, like that the math was too hard for them.
Yeah, the morality they never questioned the morality of the question itself. Like the ethical dilemma posed here, that was never even questioned, you know. It was more like, well, it's just too difficult of a calculation for, but the Germans, they do it for 7-year-olds. They do it for, and she's like, yeah, that's not a race, you know, like they're so much above us. We need to reach their level kind of thing. I mean, it was just, it's just so absurd. And yes, the banality of evil, like the, how numb you can become to these things, you know, when you're so incredibly brainwashed to believe certain narratives, presented and perpetuated and pushed by the state through all channels possible, through education, through the media, through the academic institutions and so forth. And, you know, you can certainly draw parallels to that today. We're not yet talking about, you know, killing people like this, but, you know, you see where this could end up if you're not careful. But another scene that has to be mentioned is the fake language, is the fake translation in the camps when they arrive. I mean, that's just the most brilliant. And then he's like, hey, don't ask me any questions. Don't ask me. Ask Bartolomeo over there. He knew exactly what he was saying. It was just amazing. Like, I love that scene. That's my favorite scene of the whole movie. Not because it's significant in any way. It's just because it's so, he really shows how much he cares about his kid and how incredibly creative and spontaneous and talented he is with his street smarts, you know, like it's amazing.
Yeah, he almost had to do that because if anyone else went up there to translate, then the kid would have known what's really going on.
Yeah. It's like, I lost 40 points because I wanted that bread with the jelly, you know. So,
All right. Well, very good. Well, I think that is about all of my notes as well. So, Robert, you want to kick us off with your final summary and review, and what do we want to rate this out of? Like, how many seconds get served? Number of tanks, or how many seconds get served at a meal of seven?
Yeah, I didn't even understand those riddles. Really, they were just I don't know. Maybe I'm too stupid. Maybe they're older. I don't know. But I'm gonna go with pretend tanks out of 10.
Okay, we can do that.
So life is beautiful. You know, I know that I would probably find a whole lot more to like about this film if I understood Italian, if I watched it in the original language and understood it. There's, like Olaf is saying, there's probably a whole lot of subtext and nuance that I'm missing. Absolutely. A whole lot of lost in translation issues. But to me, as a just an ignorant, you know, foreigner trying to be entertained, I found it to be a quaint throwback to an older time, an older style of filmmaking, an older style of comedy. That I think maybe there's still an audience for it. Apparently there is. Although I tend to think that the Academy Awards are really just a bunch of people jerking each other off. But maybe there are, I mean, I tend to prefer more of an audience score in general. I don't always agree with the audience. I think in this sense, I tend to agree more with the critics. But, you know, I think there's a lot to like about the film. But it's not an ideal film for me. So I would have to give this movie like 6 invisible tanks out of 10. Or if we want to go with, what were the American tanks there at the end? What was that? I forget. A Bradley?
Bradley, no, those are more current ones. Sherman's.
Sherman. Yeah. I don't know. Okay. Yeah. Sherman. That sounds right. Okay. I'll give it 6 invisible Sherman tanks out of 10. And again, that's just for a personal preference, obviously. If this movie hits you harder, you're going to like it a whole lot more, but because it has the potential, right? If you're more familiar with the style, with the culture, you're gonna appreciate this more than some ignorant foreigner will, like me. So 6 out of 10. Although probably I'll put a plus after that. 6 plus out of 10 for anybody else that's a little more cultured and appreciative of that kind of thing than me.
Okay, so the low number is actually a result of your lack of sophistication. All right, I got it.
Correct.
Okay, well, I also enjoyed this film very much. It did feel very foreign, and I think that's just the presentation and the style of it, not just the languages being spoken. And to Olaf's point, I'm pretty sure that if I understood Italian, that I would get a whole lot more out of this, a lot more nuance and a lot more of the humor and what's going on. But with what it was, I did enjoy myself a fair amount, and I think that the first part of the film with all the setups and payoffs is really well done, and it plays into the second part of the film where it makes it more believable with how he behaves in those dire circumstances, and I think it's almost necessary to have that stark contrast between the first half and the second half, and I think it plays out really, really well. I think it's poignant at the end that the father cared so much for his son that he protected not only him physically, but also him mentally, so that he could survive through this and come out and like live a fulfilling life. So I think it's a very good story, and it's well done, well acted. I think that he deserved to win the Academy Award. And I know, you know, I don't necessarily have like high opinions of the Oscars and how those happen, but I think if you are going to recognize a great performance, this is one that's worthy of it. So I'm going to give it, out of 1,000 points to win that invisible imaginary tank, I'm going to give this 750 imaginary points. So that's my rating out of 1,000. And we'll go to Olaf for your final summary and review. And you can give it a score however you'd like, sir.
Yeah, no, it's fine with the tanks. Because that's, you know, who wins the tank at the end? The American comes in. And it's not a movie, you know, that kind of like, and I'm happy. Had this been like an American movie, I would have been like bombarded with this kind of, you know, American exceptionalism, nationalism. That would have been very annoying to me. But this only kind of like shows a little bit at the end when they're coming in, when the Allied forces, you know, invade and wars, the Germans, you know, Germany loses basically. No, but this, I think Roberto Benigni is doing a terrific job in this movie. I think his character is very well developed. It's very much so. It reflects even him in real life to a very large extent. He doesn't have to play somebody he's not. Like, he is that person. You can see it. There are certain things that are so hard to explain and translate, like the way they speak in the Florentine dialect when they omit the hard C and kind of put an H sound on the words. It's just it's another experience completely. I would give it. I'm gonna give it 9.5. So 950 out of 1,000. I'm gonna give it 9.5. That's how much. Like, I saw this, and I think, you know, yes, I don't like the Oscars, and I think but I think it was better before. When they, you know, I think over time it has progressively become worse the more of sort of a political position they have adopted and mm-hmm. become more aware and more intense with that. The worse it has become. I think it was a little bit better, you know, before the millennia. So I think they probably did the right thing there. I don't think, had that movie been produced today, I don't think it would have received such a high praise from these people. So that's something, and I'm happy that it did get the recognition it deserved at the time, because it really did make you know, success everywhere, and I think it was very well done.
All right, very good. Well, so you don't quite win the tank, which I'm a little bit surprised, Olaf, because earlier you were telling me that you just watched the film again, and it's such a beautiful film. It's just incredible.
But it's like, I can't rate something to perfection. I think this is the closest to highest rate score that I would give to any movie, because you get perfect movie, that doesn't exist. You know, humans are flawed. Humans are full of sin. So I don't think they can make perfect things. You have to recognize that. So I'm never going to give a perfect score to something that is produced by mortal humans.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. I think Robert, you and I gave a 10 to Casablanca maybe. And
I think that's been pretty much the only perfect movie that we've done. Although we've given a fair number of high scores, I think, in this past year.
Yeah, I think we're trending up. I think we're getting soft in our old age, less critical.
Your old age. It's like, you know, the lockdowns make you feel really old.
Oh, man, I've lost all concept of time. It's pretty amazing. But speaking of old age, next week, Robert, we're going to be doing a movie where age is a significant factor. In fact, on your 30th birthday, I think it is, you better start running, son, because they're going to put you down as a population control measure. We're doing Logan's Run with returning guest Dr. Dennis Foster. He was last on, also talking about Nazis, oddly enough, with Conspiracy, which we did, 5-6 months ago. And that was a movie I was nervous to do because I'm not sure like how to talk about that kind of stuff, sort of like tonight. Without, I don't know, getting banned or sounding like a terrible person, but I think that we pulled it off in that one, and I think we pulled it off tonight. Similarly, you know, to how they can make a movie 25 years ago and talk about something. I think it's harder to do these things today. But anyway, Logan's Run next week, Dennis Foster. It'll be good.
Yeah, and I think that's another movie that's being talked about for being remade. I don't know. I don't know if, I mean, I've seen Logan's Run. I'll rewatch it again for next week's show. I think it's better a concept than it is a film. And I could be wrong.
It definitely shows its age.
I think it shows its age. And I think it's ripe for a remake if it could be done well. It could be a real thing. Because it is a strong concept, right? A society where they kill you because you're too old is a fun one.
Not in a, like, we actually...
Yes, it is. It's fun. It's fun, Daniel. You're not going to convince me otherwise. Come on, let's do it, everybody.
All right. So anyway, Olaf, it's been a lot of fun, speaking of fun, having you on. And you are also on for Ella King, The Purge, Spirited Away, and Snowpiercer and Webb. Links to all of those on our show notes page at lastnighters.com/164. And, of course, we'd love to have you back on sometime in the future. We're booked up for the next couple of months, but if you've got another one, maybe another Miyazaki or something like that, I think that would be great. I know that you're a big fan of his. And you're fun to talk to anyway. So anyway, speaking of talking to Olaf, we're going to continue to do this in some of the Patreon bonus content, which we call Kathleen Turner Overdrive. So you guys can find that on our Patreon page. Go to lastnightage.com/Patreon to get in on that, as well as our pre-show content, which is mostly just me showing my age again. I'm trying to get this whole apparatus to function properly. So that's usually 15, 20 minutes burned before we get into doing the show. But anyway, it's well worth the dollar or $3 or however much it takes to become a Patreon supporter of ours. Right, Robert? Right? Technically? Yeah.
That's right, Daniel. You are correct, sir.
That's right. You got any final words for our audience, Olaf, before we get into that Kathleen Turner Overdrive?
No, but I would say this. If you have to watch the movie, I would suggest, like, I get it's, you know, you don't understand, nobody understands the language, but I would recommend watching it with subtitles as opposed to the dubbed version. Mm. I think that's, yeah. Yeah,
so you're at least hearing the.
Yeah, you can hear it, and yeah, I even think that's as close as you can get, and reading if you're comfortable with that. If not, if you find it, you know, troubling, you have to keep reading the subtitles all the time. I mean, I grew up like that because we watched everything in English in Sweden, and everything had subtitles, so it's not really a problem. But I understand. I would recommend it though, like if you can. Watch it in the original language and put on the subtitles. It's a great way.
All right, sounds good. Well, you heard it here, folks. Listen to the Italian and read the subtitles, or you know, you could learn Italian and then watch it. And that's the other option, of course. All right. Well, thanks again, Olaf, and thank you, our audience, for joining us for this one. And we'll see you guys all next week for Logan's Run with Dennis Foster. And with that, we'll say goodnight from last night, everyone. Peace out. All right, and we'll continue the transmission for just a few more minutes on the Actual Anarchy podcast. When we were winding down the last night of sports on the show, Olaf, I was reminded that I think I was in Florida during the Oscars when this won Best Actor. I went down there with my girlfriend to visit my buddy who was going to Embry-Riddle in Daytona Beach, and she had relatives, I think some kind of like second uncle or something like that, however familial lineage works. But we ended up staying with them in Orlando or Winter Park. I forget.
Winter Park. That's where I am at. That's where I'm at. Winter Park.
Okay. So we were probably there staying with some old retired folks, watching the Oscars one night, just because it was on. And so that I think was the year that this won. So that's anyway, amazing. Reminded of that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. You should definitely come back.
Yeah, well, I hear all of these events happening down there, especially with Tom Woods and whatnot, and you did the Soho Forum thing recently, right?
I missed it. My work kept me here, and it's at least an hour and a half drive, so I didn't make it out there. It's 5, I think it started at 5.
Okay.
Yeah, had it on a Friday. Yeah, I was going to go, you know, the day before, I was like, I'm going to go tomorrow, and then it didn't happen because, I had to finish a bunch of stuff, my job. So unfortunate. But by the way, like when I heard it the first time, and I was a little bit disappointed because I thought it was going to be like the Gene Epstein against Ben Burgess in the debate on capitalism versus socialism.
Mm.
But then that changed. I don't know when that changed, but it changed, and now it became like Yarnbrook against, you know, Mackey, the Whole Foods guy.
Oh, about the conscientious capitalism or whatever.
I don't really like Yarnbrook. Like, I don't like, you know, I'm not a big fan of the objectivists generally. I think they're cultish, incredibly cultish. And also he has, you know, come out and insulted Tom Woods on social media, stuff like that. I don't really like the guy very much.
Mm.
So, well, I was going to go anyway because it's fun to go to events just to piss people off that you were in a crowded place and no more.
Closer than 6 feet from people?
Yeah, because we were going to go to the bar before for happy hour and stuff like that. And so I was going to go anyway, but now it didn't happen. So hopefully when that actual debate happens, because I think they will do more in Florida now that they see it went well and people were receptive and they showed up and they went well, the event went smoothly. And so, yeah, I think they're going to probably do more of them down here as long as New York is in the grip by tyrants up there, basically.
Yeah. And it almost makes some sense because, you know, Gene, he's an older guy and mm-hmm. he's in New York, but a lot of older folks in New York end up in Florida.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know how he does it. I don't know how, what makes him stay and live up there, because the city is now completely unlivable, man. I mean, everything that gave it character and beauty and attracted people to go, like you would say, well, yes, it is expensive, it is dirty, there's potential for, you know, a lot of crime and
mm-hmm. but the restaurants, like the art, the culture.
But we have all of this. Look what we have. We all have this amazing food. We have all this art and culture and musicals. And, you know, here's where the jobs are. You know, if you want to work, have a career, you're going to move where the jobs are. Who are you? Okay. They have nothing of that to rely on later. They have none of that to lean on. You know, all of that's gone. And it's not going to come back. You know, they've destroyed everything. And now that companies figure out that, okay, yeah, we're just as productive when everybody just sits home on their couch working in their underwear. So we're just going to, end the lease here and we're just going to continue working from home. Who would want to pay $3,000 to live in the ghetto when you can get a 5-bedroom house in some, like, suburb somewhere? Like, it just doesn't make any sense for people to live there anymore. So it's completely, it has turned almost unforgiving what they have. It is really what they have done to that place.
Sounds a lot like Gavin Newsom's California. There's a whole lot of rats fleeing that sinking ship too, with all kinds of big tech companies.
California still has going some kind of other, like, places. It's true. California still has some. It's so big, so they still have some pockets of, like, normal people. But New York City is totally dead. It's unlivable. It's just taken over by crime, homelessness, and drugs, and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, if you're a normal person, you kind of don't want to be in the middle of it, especially not if you have children. Why would you? So,
yeah, we saw some of that going on in Seattle recently. And you know, just 5 years ago, the problems in Seattle were about it growing in population so rapidly, and the traffic was already notoriously bad and it was only getting worse.
Yeah.
But now the problems have shifted entirely.
Yeah. Yeah.
So sad. It's sad. And this trend of working from home, I mean, it was happening anyway. Mm-hmm. I used to do, We're still on the show, by the way, but I used to do a weekly economics meeting with some folks, and one of the guys lived in West Virginia, and he had really good internet. And I was like, yeah, you know, land's cheap there. Eventually, that's what people are going to be doing, is moving to areas where they have access to things and be able to do things like telecommute and work from home. And that's going to kind of level out a lot of the real estate prices that, you know, in the cities, it went up really rapidly and really high. And by contrast, the country was a lot cheaper, but with people leaving, it's now kind of bringing up the prices out in the outlying areas and reducing the prices in the city, or at least should be. It doesn't seem to be doing a whole lot of that yet, but I was lucky to end up where I am now, because I could probably turn around and sell this for 3 times what I bought it for just 6 years ago.
That's nice. Yeah, good.
But then I'd have to buy something that's, you know, twice as much as what it was. So I think I'm probably going to stay here unless there's, like, this stellar deal on something in Florida. We might do that.
Oh.
Oh, yes. But there are deals here. You can talk to me. I'll help you out. Okay.
All right. Well, let's do that. Let's talk a little bit. My wife's open to it if it's a compelling enough situation. So
Yeah. No, we can talk more later. Like, if you want to give out, like, what numbers and stuff like that, what you could sell your property for now, and I can tell you what, you know, kind of what you can get here and where areas and stuff like that, if you're interested. You don't have to obviously give out any of that information here, but
right, that'll be Patreon bonus content for everyone. Well, let's wind down this episode here and maybe do a little bit of Kathleen Trendorvdar, though I do know it is late for you where you are. I do appreciate you coming on. It was a lot of fun, great discussion, and I have a greater appreciation for this film after talking to you, and I do want to maybe watch it again with the Italian language on instead. It might make it a little add a little more, you know, panache to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I just watch it on Amazon Prime. I mean, you don't have to buy it; just rent it. It's like $3-4 or something.
Yeah, I think it was on HBO.
That's also probably true. Yeah.
Well, anyway, thanks again, and thank you, our audience, for sticking around this long. This was one of our more laid-back post-show portions, or post-Last Nighters portions, but I hope you don't mind that too much. This is very similar to what we do on the Kathleen Turner Overdrive, actually. But you can find the show notes tomorrow at actualanarchy.com/221. We'll have a couple of show notes and then all of Olaf's previous appearances linked there. And we'll see you guys all next week with Dennis Foster for Logan's Run. Robert, any final comments for everyone?
You know, just take care of each other. We appreciate you listening. Let everybody know about us if you haven't done that. If you appreciate the show. And we'll catch you next week with Logan's Run. Should be a fun one if you like old sci-fi films. Old kind of almost a little bit corny now, but definitely kind of dystopian setting. And they seem a little bit hokey now, but I'm sure they could redo it with something new and seem outright terrifying. So should be a good one. Check it out.
All right. Looking forward to it. Well, thanks again. And maximum freedom, everyone. We'll see you next week. Peace out.
Chipmunks. CHIPMUNK. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot.